One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright.
At the organization of the church on April 6, 1830, the Lord commanded, "Behold, there shall be a record kept among you." Since that day and even before, many people in the church have kept records. Many of those records have been preserved. Others have been lost along the way. But here to talk about the new home of church history, known as the Church History Library, are Christine Cox, Brent Thompson, and Randy Olson. Christine has been here before. She was on episode number 41, Record and Remember. Thank you and welcome back.
Thank you.
We would just like to take a few moments and if you would, have you introduce yourselves to our listeners. Christine, we'll start with you.
I'm Christine Cox. I have been working at the Church History Department for 37 years now. I have a master's in library science from Brigham Young University and have been involved in many facets of the library, including cataloging, acquisitions of published materials, and working a little bit with some of the IT systems over the years. And now I'm working with the public programming.
Very good.
And public service areas.
Thank you. Brent?
I'm Brent Thompson. I've been with the Church History Department 38 years this month. Like Chris, I've worked in a wide variety of areas. I've processed and acquired manuscript materials. I've worked with indexing materials like patriarchal blessings. For the last 10 years, I've managed our preservation efforts, where we preserve the records of the church so that the church can have them 50 and 100 years from now. And so that's the main functions of the division that I direct. I have a master's degree in history from the University of Utah, and I feel very blessed to have worked for the Church History Department for such a long period of time.
Very good. Thank you. Randy?
Well, unlike Chris and Brent, I'm brand new with church history. I've been there just a little over 1 year, but prior to joining church history, I was at Brigham Young University with the library there. The most recent 7 years, I was a director of libraries at Brigham Young University. I'm fortunate today to be working with Chris and Brent as the director of libraries in the church history department, and also have responsibility for facilitating collaboration among all of the church's libraries, so the libraries that are at Brigham Young University and LDSBC and Family History Library.
Very good. Thank you. And once again, welcome to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. I think this is the right group to talk about maybe the history of church history libraries. So if we can start with, let's just go back and talk a little bit about how the church stored church history type things and how we got to where you are in the new church history library. I think due to the transient nature of the early church, were there organized efforts to preserve records and artifacts?
Certainly, as you read in the beginning, the Doctrine and Covenants, the revelations received by the prophet Joseph told them that they needed to keep a record. And so as the church historian was called in the early church, the church historian and recorder, he had a responsibility to do that. That took place primarily in two areas for the very early church. One was recording revelations, and the second area was recording patriarchal blessings and making sure that the early patriarchal blessings were kept so that they would be available to members in the future. But it was very sporadic because of persecution, because of the moving around. And so it wasn't really until the Nauvoo period that a more systematic effort was taken to gather the records, which the three of us have available today.
Do we know of anything specific that was lost over the years due to circumstances in the early church?
Well, we certainly don't have many of the early revelations. We only have copies of those as they came down to the Book of Commandments, or in other particular areas. One of the things that was a challenge was the Book of Mormon manuscript. Where do you put it so that it can be safe? It was stored in the cornerstone of the mansion house, and water got into the cornerstone, and much of the Book of Mormon manuscript was lost because they really lacked a proper place to store the manuscript. So that might be an example of something that at least was substantially lost.
So we get to Salt Lake, and we're kind of put our roots down. What are some of the more contemporary library efforts? I know you were housed in the east wing of the church office building for some decades. What was previous to that?
Let me say something about that first. In Nauvoo, as they started working on what they called the history of Joseph, we would call it the history of the church today, they began to gather materials, diaries, letters, books, documents to work on the history. Wilford Woodruff and others were involved in doing that. When they fled Nauvoo, they wrapped those books and documents up in rawhide, put them in their barrels of flour, took them to the Missouri, and then ultimately to the Salt Lake Valley. And so that's how important the records were, that even in fleeing Nauvoo, they wanted to make sure those records were saved and took them to the valley.
Good. Thank you.
And then after they arrived in Utah, all of the records were moved to the historian's office in 1856 and then later moved to the church administration building in 1917, then again to the east wing of the church office building, as Brent said, in 1972. And then most recently in 2009, we completed this wonderful new church history library.
Excellent. I think one thing that we need to clarify for listeners, and this is something that is puzzling to a lot of people who visit Salt Lake, are the many libraries that are here. You know, we have the Family History Library, there's the Church Museum of History, and then there's the Church History Library. And so somebody just clarify the differences for me.
Well, the Family History Library deals more with the vital statistics, the records to do your genealogy. So in searching out ancestors, you can find specific names and dates and places in a lot of the records that they've kept. Church History Library has been concerned with documenting the history of the church and preserving those records that document the restoration of the church and the growth and development of the church as it goes forward. We do serve quite a few family historians come in if they have LDS roots, and they find additional information about their family members coming to our library other than some of the names and dates to be able to get the work to the temple. So it adds some understanding of who these people were, put it in context of what was happening in that time during the church, and so it enriches the family historian's perspective of their family.
So once people have a good grasp of what it is they
right.
want.
First they have to know who their people are that they're looking for, and then quite often we can help people find out more information about them, who they were, what they did, through some of the ward and branch records or newspapers. We've got a great collection of newspapers.
The Church History Library and the Church History Museum are both managed by our department and are under the direction of the church historian and recorder, Elder Marlon K. Jensen. So the Church History Library primarily has books, documents, photographs that document the church. In the Church History Museum, it primarily has art and artifacts that are used for exhibits in the museum, that are used in supporting the historic site work. And so that's a little bit of the difference. And then, as Chris said, the Family History Library primarily has records from the world, births, deaths, marriages, probates, other kinds of things that help all of us to find our ancestors, whether we're Latter-day Saints or whether we have ancestors or others who aren't Latter-day Saints. It's a great resource for that.
You will find some historical records, too, in the special collections in the university library, so at Brigham Young University in Provo and BYU-Idaho in Rexburg. One of the initiatives that all of the libraries are collaborating on today, it is a bit confusing for members of the church to find their way to just the library that has their holdings, but we'll be digitizing some of our historical records in the future, and then you're essentially bringing all of these libraries together into one digital collection that'll be much easier for members of the church to use, and Brent's division actually has responsibility for that effort.
Good. We'll be talking about digitization here in a little bit more. It's hard not to think of the Church History Library as new still, even though it's been around for almost a couple of years. I would just kind of wonder if there's some kind of advertising statute as to how long you can use the word new. I'm not sure, but it is just such a beautiful building that everybody needs to come down and see it. So let's talk about the planning for the Church History Library. How long did it take? Who was involved? Who wants to?
Well, Brent headed a lot of that up, so he can probably begin.
Well, certainly a number of the leaders of the Church History Department have been involved in making that possible. So past executive directors, certainly Richard E. Turley Jr. has been very involved in doing that. And so I would describe it this way from a spiritual standpoint. We thought we knew how to build the building. We thought we knew what our requirements was. Fortunately, people like President Hinckley, either through inspiration or just because they're smarter than us, realized that we really didn't understand what needed to be done. And so Chris and I and others have been involved in this effort for more than a decade to identify what would be required, where we would place it, the kind of things that would happen.
That was one of the questions I had. Were you able to draw from, like, existing archival designs and technologies, or were you having to break new ground on this building?
No, we certainly didn't break any new ground. There are a number of fine libraries and archives that have been constructed in the United States and around the world, and so we visited a number of those institutions and borrowed from them. One of the nice things about the time period that we built in was that the archives and library and museum community had finally learned how to manage things like temperature and humidity, fire protection. Those kinds of things were really unknown in 1972 as our department began to move to the church office building. And so archives and libraries built at that time didn't have good standards for being able to do those things. And so we were fortunate to have built at the 2008 time period, 2007 time period, when we could take advantage of the technology that existed to make that to be successful.
I've worked in the conference center here where the studio is ever since it was built, and I know that as this was being built, we had a little bit of input, but they didn't really turn it over to us until construction was complete. How much input did you have as it went along?
We did a lot of assessing. We brought in some consultants to help us figure out what our processes were, how we worked together. And so I think we invited input. We would go back to our staffs and have discussions on, you know, are we perceiving this correctly, or getting a little input and then get together and make fine. And of course, you can't make everybody happy. No, not one person is happy about everything. But we would gather, I think we gathered a good share of data and input from our staff about work processes so that we could build a building that would help facilitate and keep the work moving. And I think that proved to be very, very advantageous.
One of the decisions we made early on was that we wanted the building to be flexible. We knew that over time organizations would change. We knew we would have more missionaries. We knew that employees would change over time. And so we tried to construct workspaces that would allow us to move work groups around, to move employees around, to move missionaries around, and so that it would be an effective workspace for 30 or more years. Likewise, in our storage areas, we wanted to make sure that they were flexible, that we would have some growth, that we would have some ability to to do some different things over time with the space. And at least based on our first almost 2 years, I believe that that has been successful.
In the short tour that Christine gave me, as we walked into the conservation area, it was mentioned that they had been moved, at least in the planning stages, from here to there, and finally ended up where they were on the north side, which made them happy. But it's from that it was easy to see that things were in flux until the very end, it seems like. So I'm told that the building has a green designation. Is that true, and what does that mean?
The United States Green Building Council is promoting the construction of environmentally responsible buildings, and so they call those green buildings. And so we were able to obtain a LEEDs silver certification for the building. This was the first building constructed by the church that was able to obtain a LEEDs designation. That means that we're more responsible in our use of energy. Means we're more effective in using recycled materials in the building. It's believed that that the building will hold up well and will be effective. And so we believe this is a win-win. It's a win for the community. It's a win for the church, and that it will cost less to operate it. And we believe, likewise, it's a win for the environment.
It is a beautiful building just north of the church office building here in downtown Salt Lake City. Can someone just kind of describe the layout? I'm sure we can get some pictures and a few other things on the website that will help, but just kind of give us an overview of what is where in the building.
Probably got this memorized, don't you, Brent?
Well, the first thing that's rather striking about the building is that it has a three-story lobby, which is on the west side of the building. From that lobby, you can look out and you can see Temple Square. You can see the conference center. It has a very dramatic vista. As you come in on the wall in front of you, there's a scripture: "Behold, a record shall be kept among you." And that's is there for a reason, to make sure that all of our visitors, whether they're Latter-day Saints or not Latter-day Saints, understand that we have built this building for a reason, so that we can keep the records of the church and so that we can make those records available. And so that's a very dramatic feature. As you keep going to the north then, our main public space is there, where there's a service counter where people can receive help. And so during all of our working hours, people can come in and they can find information that they're looking for. Chris can talk about this more later on, but we have computer terminals that are available to help people. We have staff and missionaries that are available to help things, and we have a certain number of things that are available for the public. The next floor up on the second floor is primarily space that's used as we acquire materials. So as books and documents come in, they're processed, they're made available to go into the storage areas. On two floors below ground and two floors above ground, we have storage areas which are on the north and on the east side of the building. So it's kind of in an L shape around the building. We have the storage areas, and then on the top two floors above the storage areas, we have mechanical spaces that are in use. And so those mechanical spaces help us to maintain temperature and humidity, help us to filter the air, to take all of the bad materials out of the air that would do damage to the materials that are in the institution. And so you might think of the building as being two buildings, a public space and an employee and missionary space, and then archival storage space that's located. On the third floor, we have the Joseph Smith papers. We have a number of other work groups that work on the third floor. On the fourth floor, you mentioned, we have the conservation lab, and we also have administrative spaces where the church historian recorder's office is located. That's currently Elder Marlon K. Jensen. those that work with him, the managing director, some of the finance, HR people. Randy's office is located on that particular floor, which isn't quite as large as the other floors that are below. And then on the lower level, then we have space that we use in supporting preservation. We have microphone cameras. We have digital cameras that help us to capture documents. We make sure that the materials are able to be preserved as they come into that particular space. Also on the lower level, we have some public spaces, some conference rooms where we do some public programming in that particular area. And those spaces, in fact, are used by the entire church campus as they schedule seminars or other kinds of work-related meetings. And then one floor below that is just archival storage, making up the last of the four floors of the storage that we have.
Very good. Thank you. You're listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. Today we're talking with Christine Cox, Brent Thompson, and Randy Olson about the new Church History Library. As you walk in the entrance hall, the lobby, there's a couple of very colorful peacock-looking carpets. Christine, can you tell me about those?
Well, the carpet was designed to reflect the end pages of an old book. The design is a peacock design. If you find some of the old books and you open them up, you see some beautifully colored designed end sheets, and that's kind of a reflection of the old versus the new. And that carpet was specially made for and designed for the Church History Library. We love to talk about it. People love to hear about the design, and we often open up some of those books and say, this is what it was patterned after.
Very good. Brent mentioned that you could tell us a little bit more about this public library area. Why don't you tell our listeners exactly what is there and what's available?
Okay, we have a library as you walk in through the gates. Anyone is welcome. We welcome all public. And I know some people think of archives or libraries or church history as a closed, but it is not closed. It's very, very open. And the feedback we're getting is it's very welcoming. We have greeters there. We do have a security guard, but just to come in and use the library, anyone can just enter. You don't have to sign in. You don't have to go through any special arrangements unless you're using some of our more rare, fragile materials. As you walk in, there's a bank of computers. We have a few materials on them already digitally. We have some photographs on there. Our catalog is on there to access the collections. And we have a few materials out in our open library area where we actually, they're heavily used materials that individuals might use as a reference material. Most of those will have another copy in our preservation collection to preserve. So high-use materials are found there in the library.
I know you use the word few, but to a person like me who's walking into there, there's rows and rows and stacks and stacks of things. So it's not just a few, if anyone was getting that in their mind.
Oh, in comparison, well, our entire collection, just in the books and published materials, we have about 270,000 volumes of materials. So to me, that's a
in
few.
In comparison, it's a few, right?
Our vaults, there are 12 of them, and they have many, many more materials. And we have all kinds of other collections behind in those storage areas that we have a reading room. We call it the reading room. And to use the materials in the stored vaults, we retrieve them and bring them into you, and they're used in a secure environment because generally they're one of a kind or they are a preservation copy. So they're used in a secure environment, and people are taught how to handle them so that we can preserve them. We have a mandate to both share and preserve. So, and often those are two conflicting concepts. So we try to make things available as well as ensure their preservation for future generations. And also we have a reference desk there, as Brent mentioned, and people can come in there. They can. We have some dedicated to just where people can come and obtain a copy of their patriarchal blessing. And so they can get it. If we have it already digitized, they can get it immediately and walk out with it that very same day. Sometimes they're a little more tricky to find because of a name change or a date or something's wrong. Then we have to do a little bit of research. But we do have that feature available there at the counter, as well as professional staff who help guide and direct researchers when they're coming in. They can either schedule some time and have a consultation where we can help provide a little bit of direction. We don't do research for people, but we provide the guidance and direction for people and get them started. And if there's a serious research need, we'll sit down with them and talk about collections, what they're trying to accomplish, where they're going with their research needs, and actually get into a little more so that they can come in and use their time efficiently. The other thing that we have done in that open space is during conference time, and it's coming up again this year. It'll be on Friday, the 1st and 2nd of April. We host a Treasures of the Collection. So we shut down a little bit early on Friday, and beginning about 5 o'clock, 5 to 9, we actually bring some of those rare and valuable materials out of the storage vaults, and we put them in some display cases, and we just have people come in and actually see the treasures of our collection. Some of the things we rotate some of these things around, so it's not the same every year. It's not the same every conference. For example, this year we're going to have a case that's going to emphasize a little bit about the church in Hawaii. And we have a great, also a journal, Joseph Fielding Smith's journal, talking about traveling from Hawaii to the British Isles. And as he walks through the streets of Nauvoo and he reminisces about Aunt Emma and Aunt Lucy, and he stops and talks to them and visits with them, but his feelings of being a child there in Nauvoo. So that's something that we haven't put on display before that will be there. And we're also going to have a case on LDS members during World War II. So as well as some of the original Book of Mormon, and a copy of the first edition Book of Mormon, Book of Mormon manuscript, some of the other scriptures, the Book of Commandments. So that's a fun thing that we do every conference, is do that on Friday and Saturday.
Looking forward to it.
So everyone is invited to come to that. It's free of charge, and you just show up.
Excellent. What, speaking of some of the treasures, what are some of the most requested artifacts or documents that patrons want to come in and actually see?
Well, everyone likes the first edition, the Book of Mormon manuscript. I think that's one of the, to actually see the handwriting of Joseph and to experience. I think we get some of the biggest aha moments out of people connecting and saying, this is something that one of the founding documents of the church, and to feel that connection between now and then, people are just really awed by that. Another one I think that's been a fun one over the years is Wilford Woodruff's journal. He was very artistic in his journal, the way he wrote, and he wrote so tiny, I don't know how he could even read it. But that's been another, to see and connect with people of the past, and some of the early photographs are also really stunning to see, yes, this is how it was, this is my ancestry if you have LDS roots, or even these are the founding individuals that helped build up this church.
As you took me through the library area with everything that is just open to whoever may walk in, one of the more amazing things you showed me was the journal history by Andrew Jensen. Could you describe what that is?
That was compiled by Andrew Jensen as a day-by-day account of events happening in the church. So he would go out and pull documents, whether they be from printed or unpublished sources, and try to organize a history, a chronological history of what was happening in the church. Then he went through and indexed all the names and places on cards, and we do have that on our desktop right now on our computers, the index. And so a lot of people will come in, and if they're starting work with their family history or a research project involving church history, that's one of the first places we guide them to say, have you checked there? Because it pulls everything together. It's almost like a giant scrapbook, pulling things together in a chronological order that's very, very valuable. And it provides clues to where to go look in certain sources for additional information. So he pulled from newspapers. There's a few letters in there. There are things out of other books that he's cut. He actually cut and paste was the original way that the journal history was compiled.
And this isn't just a couple of volumes.
No. In fact, we have a few that we photocopied, the early ones, and so it looks like there's just a few things on the wall until you go over to the microfilm cabinets and open up in their drawers and drawers. So it continues to go forward. Today, it's more of a compilation of what is happening in the world as represented through the news sources. So it got so huge, we started saying, how can we manage this? So we collect what the news sources are saying about the church in different areas around the world. So it continues to be compiled today on a day-by-day account.
So you mentioned the microfilm. Anyone can come in and find it, either this journal history or like Deseret News. What are some of the other things on microfilm?
Oh, we have Salt Lake Tribune. We have a lot of the in our open area, we have quite a few newspapers. We have some periodicals, early periodicals of the church. But then many of our manuscript materials have also been microfilmed, and they are back in the closed stacks area. So if you come in, first you'd probably use, if it's not on the open stacks area in hard copy, then you would be invited to use the microfilm. But the great advantage today with microfilm is we have machines that you can read the microfilm, and then you can download that onto a flash drive and take it home and put it on your own computer. You don't have to sit and print. And the old reader printers where you copy and print and print and print, you can find what you want, download it, and then take it home with you.
Very up to date.
We try hard.
Very nice. I noticed in the conservation area some 1800s type period machinery. And talking about old technology, if there's I'm in the audiovisual part of what happens in the church, and I've seen formats come and I've seen formats go. How does the church deal with that? Do they update their videos each time a new thing comes along? Do they keep old machines around? How does that work?
It's a very big challenge that not only the church faces, but the entire world faces. And so for people my age, audiovisual materials used to be in what we would call analog format. So you started off with the Edison wax cylinders, where an impression of the sound was recorded into the grooves. Later on, it was recorded on magnetic media with magnetic tape. Wire recordings were used where the wire was magnetized. That was another early format. Of course, there were phonograph records where the signal likewise was recorded into the impressions onto the disc. Today, almost all audiovisual materials are in a digital format. They're simply computer files. And so in our area, on the lower level of the Church History Library, we do have a lot of machines. We do have a wax recording machine that we can listen to things. We've got a wire recorder. We've got a variety of different kinds of tape machines and phonograph machines that are available. And so Today in the church, we're trying to build a digital records preservation system to allow us to migrate all of this material that's in an analog format and get it in a digital format so that we can keep it migrated over time and so that we can make more of those materials available to members of the church. And so that is a very, very big challenge for us. Likewise, material like color motion picture film doesn't last forever because the dyes and the silver material located in the color motion picture film changes over time. You get color migration, you get fading, you get other kinds of loss. And so migrating these materials is a very big commitment of the church and a very big challenge which we face as an institution to get those materials successfully migrated and maintained. And we've just barely begun doing those kinds of efforts today.
What's the connection between the analog reference you use and just regular documents?
Well, paper documents, if they're stored at a good temperature and a good humidity, can last for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Of course, the more important materials that Chris talked about, we microfilm. And so in the basement of the Church History Library, we have microfilm processing equipment that we can microfilm. Microfilm is believed to be good for hundreds of years beyond the life of the paper. And so that gives us, one, materials that we can give to our customers to use so they don't have to use the originals. But likewise, it provides very, very good preservation. Photographs, particularly color photographs, have a shorter life. And there we have a much bigger challenge in using things. But in the Church History Library, we have two kinds of storage rooms. The first one is at 55 degrees Fahrenheit and at 35% relative humidity. That's 10 of the 12 rooms that Chris talked about. And then we have two rooms that are at minus 4 Fahrenheit and at 30% relative humidity. And so that's very, very cold and very, very dry. If you think of your home freezer, there isn't any frost that forms inside of these rooms because they're so dry that doesn't occur. That's where we put high-value materials and materials that don't have as long a life, such as the early newspapers of the Deseret News, for example, are kept at minus 4 Fahrenheit. That's where we put color motion picture film, certain kinds of color photographs where we have digital images that we can make available to our customers, but we can keep the original materials for much longer periods of time.
So when we say digitization, where can a person go to find what the Church History Library is making available?
Well, today, if they come to the library itself, our digital files can be accessed from the computers we have in our reading room. But we hope within this year to make them available on the Internet. So by this time next year, members will be able to access our files from home. And that would be a member anywhere in the world.
We are loading. Right now, we've loaded over 300 items into Internet Archive. We have digitized those. It's a database that you can access on the web presently, and we're contributing to that as well.
So it's called Internet Archive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably not just the church.
No, it's several institutions that contribute to that database.
Many of the universities in the United States are contributing, and the idea is to make content of all these libraries available to everyone in the world.
Wow, that's quite an undertaking. We're talking today with Christine Cox, Brent Thompson, and Randy Olson about the new Church History Library. Very informative and exciting things are happening. While walking through one of the areas, I think it was just an office area, I saw a simple printout on someone's steel case office that said something like 3 million some odd 100,000 patriarchal blessings and counting. What was that all about?
We have been digitizing the patriarchal blessings of the church. And so I mentioned earlier that patriarchal blessings are very important records and records which the church has kept from the time that Joseph Smith Sr. was called to be the patriarch of the church. And so we've tried to capture those on microfilm. Today we're trying to make them more available. Chris can talk about that. But the way we're trying to make them more available is by taking paper copies and turning them into digital images, and likewise taking microfilm copies and turn those into digital images, and then link those individual blessings with the member of the church, with their birth date, with their membership ID, with other kinds of information, so that we can uniquely link a given patriarchal blessing with a particular member of the church.
A story that has been related in many a general conference talk is about an early church member named Joseph Millet. I assume one of you probably knows that story and wondering if you would relate it quickly.
Well, we have a great video, and it's online right now if you in the Church History Library on our website. You can actually click on it and watch it. People that come into our facility, we take them down into the public area rooms and actually show them the story of Joseph Millet. And we have the journal that it talks about in the movie. But basically a simple man who runs out of flour with his family, and he goes out seeking flour in the early years from his neighbors. And he goes out and prays about this, and because nobody else has any flour either. And so he's instructed to go see Joseph Millet. So he knocks on the door of Joseph Millet, and Joseph Millet indeed provides him with some flour. But Joseph Millet, after he leaves, this individual says, "The Lord told me to go see Joseph Millet." And Joseph Millet makes the comment at the end, "It's good to know that the Lord knows Joseph Millet." So a simple story of how the Lord knows each one of us individually. And he recorded that, and then his daughter transcribed that into another journal later on. And we do have the journal his daughter transcribed it to. And we have both that journal and the images of Joseph Millet and his wife. We have that in a display case that's sitting inside of the library. But It's a great simple story that's pulled out of a journal, but it's very deep and poignant about, you know, how the Lord knows each and every one of us, and tells a wonderful, wonderful story. So we captured that and put it into a movie format as we opened our facility, and it's been a popular presentation for everyone that comes in to visit the library.
Thank you. The little movie is entitled "The Story Lives Here," and as you mentioned, Chris, the whole point of that is that of having the story is that he recorded it in his journal, and that allows all of us to share in it. Along with the Joseph Millet story, there's some great footage of the library and just kind of an overview of what the Church History Library is all about. It's beautifully done, and I'll make sure we get a link on the site to that movie on this particular show. What else can we talk about?
Well, there is one more thing. We've had, as you mentioned when you introduced me, that I was part of the Women's Lecture Series last year. We are again doing a lecture series this year. The first one starts next week on the 10th. And this year we're titling it Women of Conviction. So that will be going on once a month, the second Thursday of each month. So we're hoping to get a little more publicity out there. And we'll have a big banner on the building during open house time, and we'll have some displays. And we'll get that information out. But the first one is going to be on LDS women and their faith, which is next week.
Excellent.
If we could mention one more thing, you mentioned what is, I think, the Church History Library's unofficial motto, "The Story Lives Here." And if you really think about it, the history of the church is really a mosaic of the lives of all the members of the church. And that church's history is still being collected. So we would encourage members of the church to keep a personal journal, to record the experiences they have in this life with their faith and their testimony being strengthened, and think about contributing those journals and the journals of their ancestors to the Church History Library. We have people come in, I think, almost every week and offer us important items from their family. So we just like to encourage members to think of us as they find materials from their ancestors.
For whoever may have contributed, my probably fourth great-grandfather, Christian Nielsen, when he was immigrating from Denmark, kept a journal, and it's in the library, and that's the only reason that the rest of us are able to share in it. Brent, any parting thoughts?
It's just very nice to have an opportunity to share a little bit about the things we do at the Church History Library. We are very blessed in our profession, the three of us, that we can work in such a wonderful building, that we're able to work in a state-of-the-art facility, both to preserve the books, documents, photographs, audiovisual materials of the church, but likewise to be able to make those materials available to the people that come through the door of the building. And so we feel very blessed to be associated with this work. And this was a tremendous commitment by the leaders of the church to build this building. There are many institutions around the world that likewise have important records, but they haven't been able to build such a wonderful facility. And so I feel personally blessed and grateful to be associated with the church and to work in the Church History Library.
So again, a plea and an invitation to anyone who wants to come down. It's open and free, and
we definitely encourage people to come in. I know we've had some people come in and they take a look at the lobby and say, "Wow, do I dare walk into the next doors?" but absolutely, we absolutely encourage individuals to come in, and there are definitely people there to help.
Excellent.
We also welcome service missionaries. Much of the work done in the Church History Department is done by missionaries.
Absolutely.
So we would encourage those who are thinking of a service mission and are interested in church history. We're a wonderful place to come.
Thank you. Again, today we've been visiting with Randy Olson, Brent Thompson, and Christine Cox about the Church History Library. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.